Fake Ignaswai comes to us from near Detroit, Michigan. She's published 5 collections of poetry, most recently The Cat Approaches, and she has illustrated all but one of her own books. I hope you'll have a chance to see copies of The Cat Approaches when we go over for the cookies and see the pictures in it too. Miss Fake Ignaswai.
I invent a chair. No legs, no back, no seat, no armrests. It is a very simple chair. I invent noise and regret it. I invent collars, garters, stays, padded bras, girdles, tight pants, indigestion, constipation, insomnia, and bad breath, all on the same day. I invent remember and forget where it left its gloves and ask it to go and find them. I sit down, listen to drawers open and close. Days pass. Finally, it brings me its hat, its tea, and a few comic phrases. I invent chimneys, the most difficult chimneys that begin deep in the earth, where it is too hot and the bricks keep melting. I invent the late children, lost between the lawn and the front door. I invent their little distracted faces, their sunburned, itchy shoulders, their dance steps and daydreams. Then I wait for them to come home. I invent the boat that is not on the river, nor on the ground near the river. I invent the boat that is inside the eyes of the man who sits, legs up, beside the freeway fence, watching the traffic. Short story, The Rings and Donkeys and Sand. Once there was a small flea who loved to sing Italian opera while sunbathing in between the hairs of a small German sheepdog asleep on the Côte d'Azur. There was another flea, his brother, who lived a miserly, niggardly life on the back of a Mexican hairless. Their sister Roxanne, dissatisfied with her ordinary life, ran away with a flea circus and, after leading a long, horribly dissipated life, died an anonymous death in the tail of a black Pekingese. The naked man wears a hat because he is worried about his hair. It escapes by wagon, by dog sled and camel out the window. He sucks his mustache, glares, and is not happy being naked, but he is afraid bees will fly up his shirt sleeves and sting him, or up his pant legs and sting him. Clothes are perilous. One takes one's life into one's hands wearing them. The naked man is annoyed and stands in the corner, calmly, ceremoniously. He will not get dressed because there is no other light in the room save the one shining through his skin. This is divided into wet and dry. He has taken his underwear off, his mustache. He looks at his toes through his foliage. Look at those toes, he says. I'm going to wash them. The naked man looks in the bathroom. There is a spider in the bathtub. He yells for the children to catch it in toilet paper, and he weeps bitterly when they refuse. He looks in the mirror. Why is his hair so wet? It is too close to the light bulb. He throws his clothes out the window. It comforts him. I invent a nightgown for him. He has his pants off and is attracted. I hand it to him. He hangs it on his fingers, on his mustache. He ties his fingers into pretty bows behind his back and walks pigeon-toed through the house, simping through his mustache. I'm the little old lady who cares for you. I'm your mother. She was rude. He was naked, singing. Gracie, 1967. You're a hillbilly, and you come to a place like Detroit, a place bigger than any place you've ever been. All you can do is pass coffee over a counter. A dark, foreign man comes along and asks you to marry him. You go home, dressed all right and wearing nice jewelry. You park the car at the foot of the road because it's springtime, and you walk up the hill to the house. Ma sticks her hand out the window, waving, until she sees how dark he is. What does she know? How far past the chicken coop did she ever go? How many men in the bushes and in cars at the side of the road with their mouths and their zippers? How far past the chicken coop did she ever go, telling me, "Didn't I raise you better?" She thinks it's easy living up here. Men are falling over themselves to marry me, what I do, because that's what they're thinking when they look at me, what I do. No man is going to kill himself hauling me off to a preacher. What does she know, always around the house, never farther than the chicken yard, except maybe to church, sometimes down the road wearing a bonnet? How can she say she raised me better? Better than what? I'm supposed to spend my life feeding the chickens. Better than what? What does she know? So he's dark and short and talks funny. No other man asked me to marry him. No other man put his hands on me like I'm special. I'm supposed to look at how dark he is and listen to how funny he talks and tell him to go when he asks me to marry him. I go home with my husband to introduce him to my folks, and my daddy comes around the side of the house, and my two brothers stand on the porch with their hands tucked into their pants, and my ma stops waving howdy do, welcome, and points her finger at him, at my husband, and says, "What are you bringing home, sister? What are you bringing home?" I was dragged down from my room at the top of the house one year when the wind threatened. Mama had heard it first on the radio and had turned it off and all the lights off and would have torn the telephone from the wall, thinking the wind and electricity would be attracted to us down the wires, but Father would not let her. I was dragged down and in my father's arms, and I was small enough not to understand the noise I heard, nor the smell of fear, my mother's voice sounding harsh and angry as she coaxed at my sister to be calm, at me, although I was rolled up like a little cat against my father's sweaty shirt. Things broke free from the house, clattering against it. I slept tucked into my father's arms, his chest noisy against my ear. I woke up sometimes and saw my sister sitting in a chair near mother, the both of them stiff as my sister's dolls. Their hands were held in fists between them, and their eyes were open so wide I saw the whites clearly, even in the dark. The room we were in smelled wet, and I could not remember it. It was so changed by the light. The chairs rose and fell. They were thicker than I remembered them, and they burst and opened and seemed to bend from stalks that began under the floor of the house. The tables glowed, their polished faces bright as the edges of flowers. Oh, Mama, we'll be killed, my sister cried, and as I looked at her, the light seemed to break her face into pieces. I took that image of her into my sleep, and cradled in my father's arms, I dreamed she walked out into the rushes and weeds near the river, and was taken slowly by the black water, first to the knees, her arms held out stiffly in the air, then to her waist, her white dress floating out around her like it was growing up from the water, and she had entered it, the meaty, large petals of a flower. It was like a bell or a globe. She hung at its center, and I watched the petals lift up and close around her. I cried out for her to come back, but the flower sank into the water. I made a net of my hair and cast it into the water, dragging against its weight. A dark thing, woven of sticks and reeds, rose up from the water. I threw handsful of mud and weeds at it, but it pulled at the net, drawing me into the water. I awoke, believing that it held me. My father tried to comfort me, alarmed at how afraid I was. I've never been in a big storm, but where I live, there are tornado warnings all the time. And one went off, and there was a loud wind. And I have a 10-year-old daughter. And the lightning, there was a thunder, and it hit, made a sound very close to the apartment, and it shook. And my daughter looked at me, and she said, "I don't want to die." And I never thought, that she thought like that. And my grandmother, when she had lived on the farm, they had a telephone. And during a storm once, electricity was attracted down the wire, and it hit her, threw across the room, and she never had another telephone in her house. So those are the two incidents, that triggered that particular poem. And do you know what they did to Grandpa? They put his box on the river. They put it on the river and him in it, dressed up so dandy, so peaceful in all that bedding, with his eyes shut and his nose shut. They sailed him out on the river like he was in a boat. They nailed it up, the air in it fluffing out his pillow, fattening out his handkerchief and his pocket. They took it down from their shoulders, there in the reeds by the bank of the river. They took it down, and he said nothing, nor did he stir about inside it, although he had a fear of the water, and he never went near it. They put him down beside it, letting go the little brass handles, and they scooped water up and onto their heads with their hands, and they kneeled beside it, and they splashed it up at one another. But there was hardly any fun in it, Grandpa so still, lying beside them. And they would have put it on fire and seen how long it would float before the water took it. They would have siphoned gasoline from a car or looked for dry rushes and twigs to set upon it and then light it up. They talked of it, squatting there beside Grandpa, breaking off sawgrass from around their feet and putting it between their teeth. He wouldn't float long, and the fire would not consume him. The water would fume and fret at the box, lap up against it, and the wood would soak through. Grandpa would wash right out of the box, and even his corpse would cry out in fear of the water taking him under. They decided against it. The nails would not be fast in the wood, although the wood would swell up from the water. The wood would move against itself, and the nails would twist free from their holes, and the box collapse upon the water. All the fancy bedding that Grandpa had made special for this occasion would be yanked and torn, first by the box coming apart, and then by the currents fighting it this way and that. I've been working from some Walker Evans photographs for a while now. And the one that's impressed me the most is Bud Fields and his family. The one that's part of Let Us Now Praise Famous Men when Evans and Agee went down south together. The animal in the photograph that this poem is from is not a horse, in fact, it's a mule. And I can't remember which of the sharecroppers is sitting on the mule. Floyd somebody, not the Tingles, not the Fields, but the other farmers, the other sharecroppers that they were with. But it became a horse in this particular poem. He'd rent the horse, and it sounding like it had asthma, and its legs shivery, and its back dropped so far your feet dragged on the ground when you sat on it, even if you was the youngest. He'd rent it, touching it on its side, all the way down to its tail and back up to its neck, picking its feet up, squinting into its face, prying open its mouth. Horse. It was, after all, a horse, and all he needed was what it was, harnessed to the plow for a couple of afternoons. He had a hand cultivator, but it was hard, slow work. That horse, I always waited for it to die, the way it shook and wheezed. And he'd hit it with the harness straps, and it would pull and rattle at the harness. And he'd have his sleeves rolled up and be hauling back on the plow, pulling against the horse, and the plow would dig into the dirt and get stuck. And he'd have the harness wrapped around him and in his hands as well as the plow handles, his feet braced and his legs stiff, his hat pulled deep on his forehead, cussing his luck for having thought to do it this way when he had good, strong kids could pull better, the horse too old and sick to care, and him sweatier, and finally so mad he wasn't mad at all, his lips tight and disappeared right off his face, and his arms lumpy with his veins all knotted out in his skin, and his shoes unlaced and full of dirt, him more buried and turned over than the earth, stiff-legged and measuring nothing with his eyes like he had done when he began, not looking at where the sun stood in the sky and how long it would take to do this much and then that much. By mid-afternoon, if he was lucky, maybe this part here and that would leave over there and back behind that little U in the trees to do. Nothing. His eyes straight ahead on the horse's backside, blinking the sweat loose sometimes, but mostly letting it settle and roll down his eyes, not looking anywhere, turning the horse around, pulling on the plow, loosening it, holding onto the animal and turning it all around to walk back up again, dipping the plow and pushing it so it was into the ground and could claw it up and out and him. As tired by the time she made him quit, as the horse had been when he had started, giving him water and looking at him suspicious and cautious of his mood and what she could do to make it better so he wouldn't be mad. Supper was late when we got home, and him saying, if that horse died on his land, the man who owned it had better come and clear it off and pay him back his money and money besides for the time lost looking at his goddamn dead horse, whatever possessed him to think he needed to use it anyway. He'd say it as he untied the harness straps from around his back and arms and hands, looking down on it like he hadn't never seen it before and didn't know maybe it belonged on trees or should be thrown in the water or used in the house somehow in the winter near the stove. It's so heavy and useless. He spoke so flat and low with no heat in his voice. It all burned out of him by the sun and the work he'd done and have to do again tomorrow and probably, by the looks of it, the next day too. And he'd heard there were better ways to live. Better ways, with only looking at the fields from automobile windows as you drove along beside them and pointed out the window and wondered what that hillbilly was doing. And he was tired of being the hillbilly and tired of being tied to this useless hide of dog food all the days of his life and to this small patch of land. Worthless was what it was. And he drank from the dipper, and us crowded together back where he couldn't reach us with the harness straps if he should try, looking at him and at her, knowing she'd handle it. She'd even out his temper before we took the horse back and headed for home ourselves. And as we went back, and it darkening, his mood toward the horse changed. And he wasn't so sour toward it. It did the best it could, old and lame and sick as it was. The air was cooler, and his body and legs weren't so knotted up, nor his arms. His sleeves rolled down, his hat pushed back on his head. The day didn't hurt so much thinking about it as we walked in the slow dark toward home. This is, if you're familiar with the photograph, I say it in this particular poem, the Bud Fields and his family. This woman here, sloppy-shouldered, squint-eyed, I don't know her, nor this room she's in. Those wooden walls and floors, all stained up, all whopper-jawed and needing nails and paint. I don't know her. The size of her nose or her mouth pulled up, the sleeping kid she holds. I couldn't name you her if you asked me, nor him, nor the rest of them all lined up and held so still. Unnatural. I've seen fish on a string down a country boy's back look more natural than they look. Posed close together, not scratching, not with the window open and the old one there looking out. And his handkerchief's not knotted tight on his neck like he usually wears it. And her, with the safety pin, the young one getting long-boned and moony, scratching her toes against the wood. I don't know her neither, nor do I care to. That suspicious old lady, head cocked, sideways looking out at me, new shoelaces in her shoes. I wouldn't look out my window to look at her, nor listen to her talking at the vegetables in her backyard garden. None of them is worth the time, and they've all been dead longer years than I've been born and living. And the road out front don't lead nowhere near their house, it sitting in the hollow down lower than that stand of trees out back of the chicken coop. And that little picture tacked on the wall back there where the old man can see it, but the kids have to stand on the washtub turned over, don't mean a thing to me. And the shirt over the door, you can see its collar here. I've never seen it on anyone or any place other than right there. It's always been just like that, part visible at the top of the picture. But mostly her. It's mostly her, I don't know. I may be seeing pictures of rooms like this, and kids sleeping or awake, all tilt-faced and dreamy-eyed like that one, or wanting to frisk by the side of the house with the dog, throwing sticks and giggling like that little one there held in between his father's knees. I may be seeing kids like that running in the street or in the alley. Even that old lady, maybe I've seen her too, or someone like her peeking around a curtain. The room behind her, dark, Never opened. And him, he's everywhere. I see him any time of the day. But her, I've never seen her. That big hand rolled into a fist, those feet bent double under her, that little edge of slip showing underneath her checker dress. No, I've never seen her before, nor do I care to see her now. Her hair all knotted and black, those bug bites showing on her chest where her dress is open, the dirt on her, and how she's all slopped down on the edge of the bed, looking like she hasn't any sense at all behind her face. I don't know her. Nor do I care to. She leaves that baby whining on the floor while she goes out in the field looking for men. She leaves it between chairs so it can't crawl too far. Every day she leaves it. She goes farther and farther, sometimes disappears in the weeds, sometimes stands in the shade of the trees looking out at the men and rubbing her hand on her arm or scratching at the ticks on her legs. She squints under her hand and sometimes follows the road, wagons coming along, sometimes cars. She lies herself down under a tree and everything stalls right there. She's slower and slower getting back. One day you'll take this picture out to show me, to have me story it for you, and there'll be an empty place at the corner of the bed. And the baby will be all knotted up and asleep on the sheet with no mama anywhere near it. She'll be gone. She'll have disappeared down the road so far, there'll be no time to call her back so you can show me this picture with her in it. She'll be in the shade of a tree or in the shade of some man's arms, and none of them will see it. They'll all be right there, lined up, looking straight ahead and never sideways to see if she's made it back in time. She'll be gone, and nobody will notice. The bed will be ditched in from having her weighed on it in that spot for so long, and the baby will be asleep. But nobody will notice. You show me this picture, and I'll say, look at how funny that bed looks, like someone's been sitting on it. There won't be any way for me to tell you about her. She'll be gone. And I could meet her on the street, and she could hello me until her throat got dusty. I wouldn't hear her. You got to know someone before you can hear them, before you can answer back. And I don't know her. Thank you very much.